Part 2. Learn.
Chapter 6.
Defining leadership and its multiple myths. Leadership is the ability to hide your panic from others. Lao Tzu, 6th century Chinese philosopher. Based on the above, it seems that some key leadership skills haven't changed much at all in 15 centuries. I can definitely relate to this one, but in the early days of Virgin at least, I might have been more specific and tweaked it to read, "Leadership is the ability to hide one's panic from your bank manager." Something I apparently failed to achieve immediately after the launch of Virgin Atlantic, when, fearing we were getting in way over our heads, Coutts Bank pulled the plug on our account. Needless to say, we quickly found other sources of more imaginative funding, but Lao Tzu would presumably have been less than impressed with my performance. The answer's yes. Now, what was the question? In the early days of Virgin, one of our people nicknamed me Dr. Yes. It was a friendly, I hope, dig at my perpetual eagerness to go along with trying new ideas. Only I knew that in part it might also have something to do with my inherent dislike of confrontation. I also mused on whether my new nickname was possibly driven by my strong resemblance to Sean Connery in his portrayal of James Bond in the 1962 movie Dr. No. But I fear that was just wishful thinking. Anyway, I did have to laugh many years later when I read somewhere that then British Prime Minister Tony Blair had said, "The art of leadership is saying no. It is always very easy to say yes." Looks like I lost out on that leadership trait as well. One very positive and rapidly spreading development in the modern definition of leadership is how it is becoming much less about power vested in a single person or role, and more about a collective process in which the authority and power is shared by a group with a shared interest. The way in which the elders tackle major conflicts and other serious global issues is a perfect example of this mode of operation. The team is comprised of elder statesmen and women from all over the world, like Kofi Annan, Grasse Machel, former US President Jimmy Carter, Mary Robinson, and Fernando Cardoso, who have come together with the single-minded goal of working together for peace and human rights. In a world of overinflated corporate egos and boardroom skirmishes, it is truly humbling to see these amazing people's work ethic and dedication to simply getting it done. This expansive networking of the leadership role means that it is no longer the exclusive domain of just those folks with a C in their titles. It always irks me to hear references to things like our leadership team. Such exclusionary terminology is a big mistake, not only because of its deification of the illustrious chosen few with C's in their titles, but more importantly, the implication that by default everyone else is not a leader. In fact, the only meaningful thing on your business card is your name and your contact information. The title beneath it says nothing about the level of respect you deserve from the person you hand it to. That's all down to what you say and do, or in some cases don't say and do, from that point on. Just as seniority is usually just a measure of tenure and has specific linkage to contribution, unfortunately titles have no true bearing on anyone's true ability to lead. The fact is that one way or another, and to varying degrees, we are all leaders in our own orbits, be it in our families, our communities, among our peer groups, or in the office. You can be well below sea level and still be a valuable leader. The really good news about the spreading of authority through a more collective approach is that it gives a much bigger stage on which a wider set of cast members get a chance to show how well they can perform. I'm not at all keen on printed corporate organization structures. You know, the ones that start with the CEO or president sitting in splendid isolation in the little box on the top row, and then fans out line by line in a perceived descending order of importance. I actually once heard a senior executive complain that his position on such a chart was an insult, as it had his box positioned a fraction of an inch lower than that of someone he considered to be his peer. My rather curt response to this utterly childish comment is not something I'd want to put in print, but suffice it to say, I think he got the point. If you really feel such charts are necessary, I much prefer the orbital variety. That's the type where the CEO sits in a circle in the center of the page, and all of his direct reports are in smaller globes that encircle the CEO. Almost as if he or she were the center of his or her own little solar system. It might sound odd, but try it. At least nobody has a beef about their respective levels, as they are all in an equidistant orbit from the sun god in the center. In my experience, any culture with an overemphasis on knowing your position creates problems that get in the way of relationships, causes resentment, and, as a direct result of this, can interfere with progress and innovation. The demarcation lines that any form of elitism creates can only serve to harden the walls of departmental silos that need to be softened, not reinforced. Also, I found that hierarchies based upon strictly observed pecking orders are usually denied the multiple layers of leadership that one finds in healthy, results-oriented, rather than status-conscious structures. Call it the don't-ask-me-I-just-work-here syndrome, if you will, but when there is an authoritarian ruler at the top of the heap, almost every layer beneath them is much less likely to make timely decisions based on their own instincts, preferring instead to push everything upstairs, and thereby reducing the chances of either getting it wrong and or overstepping their corporate marks. Lunchboxes. To this day, some cultures are much more accepting of blind respect, or at least an appearance thereof, for traditional, highly tiered pecking orders than others. Japan would be one example of this, and even a few older European companies tend to still have a somewhat upstairs-downstairs attitude to their employee class system. A few years ago, I was invited to lunch in the executive dining room of a long-established London-based company. I was amazed to find that their lordly executive dining room had its own private chefs, more waiters than diners, and the food and service were as good as many a top city restaurant, complete with a lengthy wine list. I am sure such things may still exist, even if that particular company is no longer around, but hopefully not for much longer. When the senior management of a company considers itself too precious to share the same food and dining space as the rest of their people, then, frankly, it would not be a place I'd want to work. There is a lot of ancient and still valid symbolism involved with breaking bread together. It is something that healthy families will still do, while dysfunctional households seldom sit down to a meal together. In business, too, there is a lot to be said for encouraging all of your employees to mingle over mealtimes, and if you are the head honcho, you too should try and make a point of joining them on a regular basis. When we built our new headquarters building for Virgin Atlantic outside of London, officially named The Office long before the TV show of the same name, I think we spent more time designing the centrally located ground floor dining hall than we did any other part of the facility. It was time and effort well spent, as it fast became the social center of the building, with every level of employee meeting and eating there on a daily basis. And why not? The food is excellent. Good versus evolution. While a good manager will have the ability to supervise others, keep them within company guidelines, play by the rules, and read the maps they're handed, all this tells you nothing about how comfortable they will be going off-road and breaking new ground. Striking out in new, unexplored directions takes a whole different mindset, and one that often means breaking, or at least massaging, a few of the old rules. Management is much more about maintaining processes, disciplines, and systems than about changing them. Strong leaders, on the other hand, while maintaining stability, must have vision, creativity, and, perhaps most importantly, the ability to influence others to follow and support them in the challenges of moving an organization into uncharted and often highly risky territory. Good leadership is by definition all about taking the venture forward and finding viable new avenues where the business can evolve and prosper. Poor leadership, on the other hand, typically tends to be static, much more about protecting the status quo, and, if there are any around, resting on laurels. This don't rock the boat approach may have been a viable business model 20 years ago, but at the frenetic pace of business today, it is no longer an option. To stand still today is to go backwards, and quickly. While I have found that outstanding leadership tends to come in a huge range of very different and often quite quirky and eccentric packages, poor leadership usually displays a lot of common denominators. There are also a lot of contradictions, however. For instance, how would one rate a leader with the reputation for being such a great guy? He never gets in anybody's face and just lets us all get on with our jobs. Such an individual could either be a highly skilled delegator or just someone who has no stomach for confrontation. While few people, myself included, genuinely enjoy confrontational situations, when they arise, dealing with them in a timely manner is an inescapable and important part of effective leadership. Some leaders are frequently guilty of shying away from anything that might result in an altercation, in the mistaken impression that this will make them more likable to their employees. The reasons for an aversion to facing up to confrontation can be several. Either they just don't have a sufficient level of confidence in their own technical understanding of the problem to be able to stand their ground and win, or frequently they'd simply prefer to turn a blind eye in the hope that by ignoring the issue, it will over time somehow manage to sort itself out. Unfortunately, failing to confront a problem while it's at the smoldering stage will more often than not only lead to its proliferation into a fully fledged fire that is much harder to extinguish and can do a lot of long-term damage. Another relatively common confrontation avoidance technique with weak leaders is to always have someone else on hand to take care of the dirty work on their behalf. This will typically involve having a senior management hatchet man to handle anything where they don't want to risk dirtying their own hands or damaging their Mr. Nice Guy reputation. Is this an example of skillful delegation? I think not. There seems to be a lot of confusion around the subtle but critical differences between delegation and its first cousin, relegation. Simply stated, delegation is handing on the responsibility for a situation together with the authority to resolve it. Relegation, on the other hand, is simply pushing a problem away, but without including the power to really do anything much about it, except perhaps to shoulder the blame. In short, one of the most common mistakes to be found in poor leaders is an inability to understand the difference between these two ways of working. In the same way that this kind of leader is skilled at relegating blame, they are usually very good at holding their people accountable. Everyone, that is, except themselves. Take me to your bleeder. A classic example of what can go tragically wrong in the absence of smart, forward-thinking leadership has to be what happened to Kodak. For over a century, Kodak was virtually synonymous with photography all around the world. They invented the automatic camera over 100 years ago, and a Kodak moment, a photo opportunity, became part of the English language. When I was about 12 years old, I remember my excitement one Christmas at getting my very first camera. It was the coolest camera of the day, a Kodak Brownie box camera, and I was beside myself with delight. But times change, and while Kodak should have been in the driver's seat when digital photography first emerged, in 1975 they had developed a digital camera that was the first of its kind, the product was soon dropped for fear it would threaten their existing photographic film business. Instead of embracing the opportunities that the new technology presented and exploiting their resources to lead the charge, Kodak's senior management instead seemed to bury their heads in the sand. It was almost as if they believed that if, as the industry leader, they were to ignore it, then digital might magically go away. But like King Canute, who thought he could turn back the tide, they were very much mistaken. Eventually, seeing the error of their ways, Kodak condescended to try and create contrived synergies such as photo CD that fell somewhere between their traditional analog offerings and digital technology, but compromises seldom work. While Kodak tried desperately to hang on to the past and the huge 70% profit margins they had enjoyed from their traditional film business, newcomers to the camera game like Sony swept right on by them and, as they say in the US, ate their lunch. Kodak's share price dropped by 80% in 2011, and they filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in January of 2012. It took until September 2013 for Kodak to emerge from bankruptcy protection as a greatly pared down and, I suspect, much wiser company. The fact that other major analog-era imaging companies like Canon, Nikon, and Leica all successfully navigated the transition to digital would seem to indicate that the only plausible reason for Kodak's rapid decline was a catastrophic failure in leadership. And, as is almost always the case, leaders who spend too much time looking in the rearview mirror are seldom positioned to navigate the road ahead. My interest in the Kodak story stems from my own experiences with the winding down of our once-booming pre-digital Virgin megastore business. Like Kodak, I too was guilty of a very similar reluctance to accept the havoc that digital technology was about to wreak upon one of our core businesses. Virgin Megastores, our music retailing business, was very near and dear to me, I suspect in much the same way as the film business was to Kodak. Virgin had been in the record retailing business since opening our first little shop in London in 1971. In fact, back then, it was our only business. By the early 90s, that one shop had expanded to scores of gigantic Virgin megastores all over the world. But just as it was doing in the photography world, digital technology, especially in the shape of Steve Jobs and iTunes, was about to dramatically transform the recorded music business forever. The industry had seen an ever-evolving parade of different formats over the years, from vinyl record albums and singles to 8-track tapes, remember those, to cassette tapes, which heralded the portable era, and eventually compact discs that, for a while, everyone seemed to think were the ultimate solution. But it wasn't to be, and the arrival of online digital downloading rendered CDs, and with them our bricks-and-mortar retail model, obsolete faster than you can say, I cry. We desperately tried to compensate for the nosedive in CD sales by stocking all kinds of other products, like computer peripherals, board games, books, and even pop culture fashion items. Then in 2005, we made a belated last gasp attempt to squeeze our way into the download business with Virgin Digital and the Virgin Pulse MP3 player. But it was incompatible with the all-conquering iPod, and so became a classic case of too little too late. Mea culpa. As appears to have been the case at Kodak, I was guilty of turning a deaf ear to the dire warnings, and as a result, I paid the price, literally. We still have a limited interest in a couple of stores, but we could have saved ourselves a lot of money had we, or that should really be, had I, been willing to read the writing on the wall a little sooner, cut our losses, and bid a fond farewell to a business that had served us well for 3 decades. As a somewhat quirky friend of mine likes to say, if things don't change, they'll be the same tomorrow as they are today. Well, things do change, and in cases like the digital revolution, you have just got to recognize you've come to a watershed and move on. Leading from the periphery. Another myth on leadership is that successful entrepreneurs should be able to take their ideas and run with them when they become the nucleus of a new business. Management guru Peter Drucker deftly defines an entrepreneur as someone who searches for change, responds to it, and exploits opportunities. Innovation is a specific tool of an entrepreneur, hence an effective entrepreneur converts a source into a resource. None of that suggests to me that an entrepreneur is expected to stay around to lead a company once he or she has set the ball in motion. But neither does it say that they cannot stay around the periphery as a force for ongoing change. I sometimes think that entrepreneurs have a lot in common with scouts for professional sports organizations. They are out there talent spotting, whether with established stars on other teams or undiscovered, up-and-coming raw young talent that hasn't made it big as yet. They usually understand how the corporate puzzle fits together every bit as well as the team manager, but are the unsung heroes who have the insight to recognize something special and recommend bringing in new and better players to improve the team. In fact, they often add more value to the overall picture by not trying to manage it, something I didn't cotton on to early enough with megastores. It is no small coincidence that I felt such a strong tie to our music business, as it was the last one I actually ran before I drifted off into my new career as a serial entrepreneur. That said, over the years, I have spent a lot more hands-on time around some Virgin companies than others. The early years at Virgin Atlantic would be one example. But I usually make a conscious effort to try and stay out of the day-to-day decision-making, as it really isn't my thing. And besides, when I expect our senior people to take ownership of their decisions, then the last thing they need is someone like me continually trying to foist his usually inexpert opinions on them. What an entrepreneurial eye can bring to an operating business, however, is that same spirit of inquisitiveness that recognizes gaps that can be filled with new products and services, and in turn, occasionally, new spin-off business opportunities. At the same time, the Virgin way of managing our businesses is all about maintaining and promoting that almost childish curiosity level in our people to ensure they are never accepting of the status quo and always looking for ways to improve upon it. The subject matter experts are often way too willing to take the obvious path. Their expertise, after all, is based on what they have seen and done in the past. And so every once in a while, a few jabs in the ribs from an annoying entrepreneur is not a bad thing. As David Tate, who was one of the first people at Virgin Atlantic, likes to tell it, in the early stages of the airline, I reminded him of his young kids, as my favourite question was always, why? And to this day, it's probably still my favourite question, especially with a new business segment about which I know very little. It's not that I don't trust the staff, it's simply that I want to understand how things work. The upside to my constant whying is often that it makes people start to revalidate a few long-established practices, and in the process sometimes stumble on better ways to do them. Over the years, numerous Virgin people have found that telling me something will never work is by no means the best way to convince me we shouldn't try it. Quite the opposite, in fact. As trite as it may sound, one of my favourite lines when someone expresses doubts about trying something new for reasons like, it has never been done before, or it's been tried before and no one has ever succeeded, is to say, with a smile, great, well, why don't we look at how we can do it differently and be the first ones to make it work? That was pretty much what we did with Virgin Atlantic, and once we got it in the air, we have always maintained the same approach. I mean, how many other airlines would have seriously considered a crazy idea like putting massage therapists or stand-up bars on board its airplanes? Sometimes not knowing enough about the correct way to do things and doing them anyway can open up the most amazing new doorways. While I have never felt either the urge or the need to go back and grab the reins at any of our companies, some entrepreneurs have found that knowing when to step back into a company they founded can be every bit as important as knowing when to exit. The classic example has to be how, after a 12-year exile, Steve Jobs returned to Apple, and how the company, unfortunately for my beloved megastores, which was on the brink of failing, really took off when Steve reassumed the full-time CEO role after a spell as what he jokingly called I-CEO for interim CEO. At Google as well, in early 2011, 10 years after he had stepped out, co-founder Larry Page returned to the company as full-time CEO. When he left, there were barely 1,000 employees, and when he returned, there were 25,000. Needless to say, a lot changes in any company that grows 25-fold in just 10 years. When Larry returned, his priorities were never officially announced, but everyone seemed to agree it had to be stripping away some layers of management to reinvent that start-up energy and buzz that always seems to foster an altogether higher level of creative energy. Warding off the social media threats of Twitter and Facebook, which were both still in more adolescent corporate stages, was also, I am sure, a big motivator in Larry's decision to step back in. One way or another, the company has continued to flourish since Larry's return to the top job. When he took over as CEO, Google's stock price was hovering around the $500 mark, and the last time I checked, it had remained in a steady ascent and was pushing $1,200. So don't believe anyone that tries to make blanket statements to the effect that entrepreneurs are or are not well suited to the task of running the companies they created. The inescapable fact is that no two people and no two companies are alike. And even then, circumstances and economic conditions can complicate any given scenario. If they persist in pushing for an opinion, then I would simply respond by saying, do the names Steve Jobs and Larry Page mean anything to you?